This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio, broadcast, and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to talk about a subject we've touched on before on our show, that is regenerative agriculture, but we're going to get a new angle on it from Karin Manhus. He's the founder and CEO of an organization called Terra Mera. He joins us from British Columbia, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Karin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here with you.
You're an entrepreneur. What is your opportunity with regenerative agriculture?
So our goal is to work with farmers to build the world's largest regenerative farming initiative and to build out technologies to allow it to scale much more efficiently and effectively than it's been able to before. Regenerative agriculture is quite different from some of the other forms of agriculture, like, you know, organic, that in that it's not a prescriptive set of things. It is a set of principles, tools, and practices that helps pull carbon from the air, amongst other things, and helps generate better soil health and more soil. Regenerative agriculture, a set of tools and practices that pulls carbon from the air, pulls it through growing plants, and transfers it underground into the soil where it belongs. It also helps pull and store that carbon from the atmosphere and restore agricultural soils. So it's different from what the industry has called sustainable agriculture, which maintains the current health of the environment. Regenerative agriculture actually goes further and actually improves the land with each growing cycle. That in turn improves the farmer's bottom line. One of the things that is great about regenerative agriculture is, you know, it can apply both to conventional and organic types of farming. It's really about practices that generate the soil and improve the productivity for the farmer, and actually pull carbon out of the atmosphere into the soil, where it actually helps generate healthier soils.
So two things here: you're making better soil, and you're also improving our global warming issue a bit.
Yeah, I mean, farming, ranching, and agriculture in general is, I think, needs to be recognized for the role that it has and has the potential to play. Agriculture is really ground zero, not only for providing the food and nutrition we need, but also it's ground zero for some of the biggest problems that we're facing. Too often, agriculture gets painted into this negative ground of being part of the problem, but agriculture is actually part of the solution. And the great thing about regenerative techniques is not only does it help farmers and ranchers be part of the solution, it actually increases the economics and return and bottom line to allow farming and ranching to be sustainable and profitable for years and decades into the future.
Well, let me tap that first question one more time here, because you're an entrepreneur, so there is a profit motive, a little bit of one at any rate here. So what is Terra Mera? What's the Global Center for Regenerative Agriculture? And what's the value added that you're providing to people who are interested in regenerative agriculture?
Terra Mera is a company focused on the use of technologies to really transform how we grow food and the economics of agriculture. We have two major technology platforms. One is a platform we call Actigate, and it is really focused on doing more with less with agrochemicals. So it is a set of technologies, advanced computing and computational chemistry, to really understand how the inputs that we use in agriculture can be made more efficient. Today, 50 to 90% of the inputs that we apply on farms get washed away into the environment, depleting, amongst other things, soil carbon, but also farmers are buying products that are intended to be taken up in a certain place. But because of the formulations that we have right now, that inefficiency, only a small amount of it gets taken up. It's kind of like if we had a headache and instead of being able to take a painkiller, we took a shower in aspirin water. Eventually, enough of that aspirin would soak across the skin to get rid of the headache, but it's not the most efficient thing. In medicines, there is a whole science around drug delivery, so that you want to make sure that the active part of that medicine actually gets to where it needs to get to. So, for example, if you have a medicine for heart disease, you want it to get to the heart. And if it gets all, you know, into the liver, it's not going to do that much. So Actigate, what it does is, you know, they're compounds that can go into formulations that the manufacturers of agrochemicals can use to make their agrochemicals more efficient. So that's an area we've been working in for a while. To be able to really understand that, we built up this data science platform that is focused on understanding what's happening in the plant and in the system. And so we've developed a really advanced system that is able to not only very accurately using images and sensors be able to track things like yield, but also quality. We can track things right down to certain materials like sugar content or protein content. We started this by wanting to understand when we put one input or another, how are we actually increasing the yield, decreasing the loss from pests and disease, and increasing the quality of things like, you know, that are important for that particular crop. As we started building that out, we realized it's not only about the plant itself, but it's also about the soil. And so now, with this initiative, what we're actually doing is taking that technology and starting to see into the soil in terms of what's happening. So soil health is complicated, but we always look at, like, what are the key metric or the key thing that we can measure that tells us how the whole system is working and how the system is getting better. So soil carbon is one of the things we focused on, because if we can increase soil carbon, that actually is a measure of soil health as well. And so what we're doing now is putting this technology to really be able to understand what the level of soil carbon is. And as part of this initiative, over the next number of years, over the next 3 to 5 years, really ground truth that so that we're able to accurately determine what that level of soil carbon is without having to have somebody go into the farm and take a soil sample every time we want to know that. That we could actually do this remotely using sensors and imaging to be able to do that. So we set up for ourselves these audacious goals to, by 2030, use Actigate technology to get it out into the industry to reduce the synthetic chemical load in agriculture globally by 80%, while increasing per acre farm yields by at least 20%. If we could do that globally, you know, that would be enough to feed an additional billion people. And the third audacious goal is to increase soil carbon by at least 100%. And so, you know, our business model is to use that technology in various ways to either license to agrochemical companies with Actigate, or to get out into the field to allow farmers to be more efficient. And, you know, with soil carbon, we want to actually create a new source of farm income. And, you know, we would take a percentage of that that income that would then go to farmers for increasing the carbon in their soils, which also has an economic effect that makes their farms more productive.
Karen Manhus is the CEO, founder of Terra Mera. You can find out a lot of information about his enterprise at regenerativeag.terramera.com. Terra Mera is spelled TERRAMERA. I went up on that website, Karen, and you had a very provocative comparison between Canada and the Netherlands, talking about the incredible efficiencies that the Netherlands have in terms of growing food.
Yeah, I mean, the Netherlands has really focused both their need for food production with their focus on efficiencies and engineering to produce a very, very efficient system of agriculture. We always think about the greenhouses, but it's also in both greenhouse and field agriculture. You know, in North America, inefficiencies and uncertainties are a big result of the thin farmer profits that we have. You know, Canada is an interesting example. Even before COVID in Canada, for example, net farm income dropped by more than half from 2016 to 2019. So that affects farm families and the industry and their struggles in the U.S. as well. And with COVID, the breadth and depth of these issues impacting agri-food has probably never been more challenging. And when farmers struggle financially, food production, the agriculture sector, and the economy suffers too. So in the Netherlands, they have produced a system where they're over 150 times more productive per acre than Canadian farmers are.
Wow.
What our goal is to increase the production and efficiency and therefore profits of farmers here in North America by adding that intelligence and advising farmers what they can do to increase that efficiency, really bringing together that idea of, you know, engineering and intelligence to make that farm more productive per acre, but also bringing in the concepts of regenerative agriculture to at the same time make it even more efficient than the Netherlands by being able to sequester more carbon through regenerative practices.
Well, most of North Dakota and a fair amount of Canada is monoculture. What are the significant obstacles to changing that status quo? And obviously in 10 years, if you could, you know, get the kind of output or return on investment that you're getting out of the Netherlands, that would be a pretty strong incentive. But how do you make the sale?
Right. Well, you know, one of the most famous pioneers of regenerative agriculture is right there in Bismarck is Gabe Brown. And of course, he converted his 5,400 acres of land to a commercial regenerative farming, and actually is a good set of data over, you know, almost 30 years of making these changes. And as a result, he's made his farm, he makes on average about $100 per acre of annual net profit compared to, you know, in agriculture, you know, if a farmer is making anything, it's generally around 10 cents to $3 an acre of net profit. So one of the things that we're focused on is how do we learn from the best practices of how this has been done and make it easier to be able to implement, but also start putting in some incentives that make it valuable and economically valuable for farmers to start making that switch, both in terms of helping to pay for the equipment that might be needed, but also in trying to understand and educate what are some of the changes and differences that need to be made. So one of the things that we are looking to do is start getting farmers paid for the carbon that they're actually sequestering. And that gives them the incentive and a new revenue stream to actually focus on soil carbon and implement regenerative techniques. At the same time, our technology and tools would allow, you know, farmers using their cell phone or a computer to be able to get advice on what they can do to actually both increase the carbon so that they're being paid for that carbon, but also increase the profit, you know, what things they can do to actually increase the performance of their crop.
So this is where the government gets involved. You've raised millions of dollars for your project in Canada. Are you looking to the government of Canada to provide this kind of carbon payoff piece?
Yeah, I think we're looking for both government to help incent, but also the private sector as well. We've partnered with companies like Microsoft on this. Microsoft, of course, is also wanting to be able to get carbon that actually offsets all of their carbon emissions they've ever had since they were founded. So, you know, globally, you know, I think there's a role for both governments to help incent farmers to better practices, but also for private companies to be able to do that with carbon credits. One of the things that the new government here has actually announced is a new regenerative agricultural network that actually, you know, is bringing together what we're talking about and using this as an example of how we may be able to scale this across the country, across the world. So this regenerative agriculture network will actually bring together farming and ranching with the agritech, the data and agrotechnologies we're developing to enhance production. So including things like precision farming and mesh networks and to be able to do that.
Well, in this country, and I suspect in Canada, seed is patented, you know, and certain farm implement technologies are patented. Is this becoming a competitive industry? Is Terramera getting in on the ground floor of something that will become a major industry to improve the efficiency of agriculture?
Yeah, I think more and more today, we need to do more with less, and we need to make sure that agriculture is sustainable, you know, for generations and years into the future. And this is a critical part of maintaining the integrity of agriculture and seeing it into the future. So yeah, it is the ground floor. More of the same is not going to change our profitabilities into the future. So we need to be looking at this. And what one of the things that we are hoping to actually build is a platform that people, farmers and the industry can trust, that is able to allow farmers to understand how what they do actually affects not only their soil carbon, but really their profitability per acre, and see what, you know, products and tools and technologies they actually could do and change and implement on their acres, and estimate what that will do to their bottom line. And so that's a really powerful way that farmers can have more certainty around what products they should use, what techniques they should use, and how they can actually, you know, take control of the decisions that affect their farm life.
Regenerative agriculture is been talked about in our country for quite a long time now. It's gaining some steam, but it's not where obviously the proponents want it to be. How receptive are Canadian farmers to what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think regenerative farming is still something that requires a lot of education. But if we can make it easy to start adopting, we can make it financially lucrative to start adopting. And we've got the technology and tools to make that easy to adopt for farmers. That's going to be the key to being able to scale this.
Well, we look forward to following this further, and we'll probably be calling you again to find out how you're doing on your 10-year plan, because it sounds very ambitious. Again, for our listeners, it's regenerativeag.terramera.com. We're talking with Karn Manus, and he is the founder and CEO of Terramera. Karn, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay by Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel of Bismarck. Conveniently located in the heart of downtown, with many opportunities to explore shops, restaurants, and nightlife within walking distance. More information on booking your next hotel room online at radisson.com/Bismarck.
Patrice Tanaka had a high-flying Manhattan PR agency, but the shock of 9/11, subsequent slump of her business, and a husband with a fatal brain tumor sent her to an executive coach who
made me remember that when I was a young girl of 8 or 9, my dream was to dance like Ginger Rogers.
Can't you hear that hot marimba? Let yourself go.
Dancing transformed her health, her professional work, really her whole life, and led to her book, Becoming Ginger Rogers. We talk about it, part of Humanities Indies One Book, One North Dakota series, this Sunday, 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. History has a way of repeating itself, which is a good reason to look into how issues were discussed and resolved in the past. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history and the creator of the Plainsfolk essays we feature on Main Street. Today's piece is titled, Informed Citizenship in the Country Schoolhouse.
The question, money versus fame, was decided for the affirmative, reported the Golden Valley Chronicle on the debate featured in the first meeting of the Belfield Literary Society in February 1908. But wait a minute. Which was the affirmative, money or fame? Well, no matter. The society moved on with an announcement that its next meeting would debate the question, resolved that the United States should own and control the railways. Never let it be said that our forebears a century ago were out of touch with the progressive issues of the day. The literary in Belfield, we read, was, under the efficient management of our teachers, Mrs. Beebe and Miss Collins. A previous Plainsfolk essay described how the literary society, rose up in the 1880s and 1890s to become a fixture in prairie communities, enriching their cultural lives and focusing neighborly sociability. It was no accident that the literary movement found its home in schoolhouses, for educators promoted the literary as an institution for improvement. This organization has its place in every school district, wrote one such authority in 13, as it provides a means whereby the people and the pupils can hold meetings once or twice a month in which the Lyceum idea is dominant. The programs, this writer continues, should consist of addresses, essays, papers on practical subjects, debates on public questions, dramatic exercises, personal reports on conventions, and recitations and declamations. The influence of such a club is far-reaching as it trains the people for competency and efficiency in public work. In other words, informed citizenship. The normal school over in Valley City was a training ground for literary societies. In the early years of the 20th century, four student literaries, the Athenians, the Cleonians, the EBCs, and the Eclectics, vied for supremacy and for the Brownson Prize for the best society. Even over at the Agricultural College, graduates proudly declaimed their participation in the Athenian or the Philomathian Literary Society as a resume item. And oh, those debates wherein local citizens went at it hammer and tongs and then afterwards joined in jolly camaraderie. The debates were the public favorite. Some of the questions, like the railroad debate in Belfield in 1908, were overtly political. Others were matters of more general civics. At Eden Valley School of Williams County in April 1911, the question was, resolved that the American Congress in its two houses is the most perfect form of legislative body. It was important to keep the proceedings grounded in country life, however, and so the next month's question was, resolved, that a small horse is better adapted to farm purposes than a large horse. You have to know a little bit about agricultural history to understand that this question cut to the quick of the nature of farm systems at the time. By 1920, agricultural debates were reflecting modernization and mechanization. The Botno Courant, in February of that year, reported that out at Bentick Schoolhouse, following a violin solo by Ole Sanis and a reading by Melvin Sanis, there was a spirited debate of the question, resolved that horses are more practical for farming purposes than traction power. Cecil Spafford and Richard Steinhaus carried the night for the affirmative, but by a split decision of the judges. And then the literati enjoyed a vocal duet by Elda Bronson and Ruth Talcott, after which Eric Sanis and John Talcott gave a demonstration of mind reading. I just don't know what that was about. Likewise, I had to do some research to understand what was meant by reports of a shadow social at the Rose Hill Schoolhouse of Williams County in 1912. In the spirit of the literary, shadow socials are worth exploring in a future Plainsfolk essay.
That's Tom Ezern. Tom also hosts the Willow Creek Folk School Friday evenings on Facebook. It's easy to find. Go to facebook.com/plainsfolk at 8 Central. Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson offers his insight into the week's big stories, and Matt Olean reviews the new Borat mockumentary. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The mayor of Fargo has signed an executive order that will limit occupancy in bars and restaurants. Tim Mahoney's order mandates that bars and restaurants cap their occupancy at 25% or 50 people, whichever threshold is met first. City Attorney Eric Johnson says the mayor's order comes down as COVID-19 levels are spiking and hospitalization rates are at or near capacity. Johnson says violations of this order will carry penalties.
Violations are an infraction. That's a criminal offense that can be charged out in municipal court. The maximum penalty is a $1,000 fine. The fine amount itself is set by the judge. As to facilities that have liquor licenses, their licenses require them to comply with laws and rules of the city as well. And so it's certainly possible that if somebody were flagrantly violating this, that the city commission might schedule a hearing and make a decision as to whether or not it was violated, and if so, whether perhaps a suspension of a day or two or perhaps longer might be imposed as a as a punishment.
Johnson says the order is taking effect Monday, November 16th at 8 a.m. He says this will give businesses time to understand the order and make sure they are in compliance. The order is currently set to expire in the early morning hours of Tuesday, December 15th.
This is a turning point legislative session. It's going to be different than it's ever been before. And so you're a part of history, folks. You're a part of history.
That's how North Dakota Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner is characterizing the upcoming legislative session. New rules caused by the COVID-19 pandemic will allow legislators to work and vote remotely. He says they will be able to participate and vote in floor sessions, even though they may not be on the floor. Wardner says they will be able to join the debate as well.
We're video conference. We're ready to roll.
Wardner says social distancing rules will not allow legislators to be on the House or Senate floors, even though that's where they had their desks. He says some committees will be put into different rooms. For example, House Appropriations will move to the biggest hearing room in the Capitol, the Hoglund Room. Wardner credits the information technology staff for making this happen.
Hey, we're going to keep rolling, man. We're going to roll. We're going to get the job done. Nothing's going to stop us.
Lawmakers will meet for their organizational session December 1st. And a co-captain of the Fargo Area Salvation Army says despite the world being radically changed, the 2020 Red Kettle campaign is underway. Jerry O'Neill, formally kicked off the Red Kettle season this morning at the Westacre Shopping Center.
It's the largest fundraising campaign of the entire year, so it's very significant for us. Not something that we could just put off until hopefully COVID disappeared, but something that we need to find a way to continue to do.
O'Neill says the local campaign will follow the National Salvation Army theme of Rescue Christmas.
As you know, this has affected a lot of people, and so there are many thousands of people across our country that perhaps last year would have been donors and this year could possibly be service recipients.
O'Neill says they will be taking many precautions to protect the bell ringers and the public, but he says there will be challenges.
A lot of our volunteers are older, and so I think we're going to see a significant decrease in volunteers manning the kettle. And the other thing is that the traffic count at a lot of these locations with online buying and things like that, the traffic count that we normally depend on for kettles is going to be down significantly as well.
The Fargo Area Salvation Army has set a fundraising goal of $900,000. The goal is identical to the one set in 2019. O'Neill says last year they fell just shy of meeting that goal. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
There's the wire machine. It's time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson. We do this every Friday, and Dave, every Friday we sort of talk about the same thing over
Pretty
and over
much,
again because
yes.
there are new wrinkles every week, and that's COVID-19 is just a firestorm across our region.
It absolutely is, and it's reflected by some actions taken by government this week. We'll start in Grand Forks, where the mayor has added some new restrictions to his first comment about closing bars at 10 o'clock. They're going to be limiting capacity of bars to 50%. They're going to say if you are at a bar or a restaurant, you cannot stand up and eat or drink. You must remain seated except when you're entering, leaving, or going to the restroom. So there's real concern about that. Jamestown has passed a mask mandate, and they're right now debating whether there will be teeth in that. Minot has passed a mask mandate. Bismarck has passed a mask mandate. Fargo is apparently going to do a little bit tougher mask mandate. At least that's what the indications we're getting are from the mayor's office. And in Grand Forks, this is a little bit unusual, but the state health officer or the regional health officer does have the power to have one of these orders based on a medical emergency. And he's thinking about that he will have a mask mandate with penalties that could be Class B misdemeanors.
Wow. Okay.
So it is getting very serious.
Well, Danielle Webster has been keeping track of the COVID numbers, and I know yesterday she posted 1,800 new COVID-19 infections. I can remember, Dave, back in the spring when we were looking at 100 as a spike.
Right, exactly. And now it's really spiked.
Yeah, it sure has. And Governor Burgum has put the entire state now in a high-risk category. Of course, there's still no statewide mask mandate. There's just this statewide recommendation
right. And
individual jurisdictions are going to the mandate route, but this is a very serious issue in terms of hospital staffing and other essential personnel.
Yeah, and one of the orders that the governor did come up with this week has turned out to be a bit controversial. He said if you are a nurse and you test positive for COVID, but you're asymptomatic, you can work in a COVID ward. Now, that's caused some real discussion, not only in North Dakota, but nationwide. Does that make any sense? Well, I hear that some hospitals have said we need the personnel. The people in the Long-Term Care Association were behind it, but there are some organizations who wonder if that's a good idea. So the debate rages on.
Yeah, it has to do with where are those asymptomatic workers when they're not in the COVID-19 ward. It has to do with how quickly can we turn tests around. I know the governor is talking about 15-minute tests now for these critical employees. Well, that would make a huge difference because otherwise you're offline for 2 days or so.
Exactly.
And again, we keep getting back to the fact that COVID-19 is raging and people need to be personally responsible for themselves and others.
And you have seen a lot of the studies are saying a lot of the spike you're seeing now is the 18 to 30 age group, very social. They want to go out and socialize and go out to bars and things like that. I know that Governor Walz mentioned that in his news conference this week, that he thinks that's one of the causers in Minnesota for spiking. But another thing that's coming up, of course, is we've got holidays where people will spend indoors, like Thanksgiving holidays. I know in my family, just as an anecdote, we aren't doing an in-person Thanksgiving holiday because we're very concerned about, you know, spread in smaller groups in confined areas.
Well, Governor Walz, I know, has actually been sparring with the Minnesota legislature, but now, after the election, they seem to be more agreeable. They're more, you know, we're all in this together now. It's not, people who are against mandates or against closing or whatever. They're aware that this is just reaching out of control status.
It is.
There are not enough ICU beds, apparently, in Minnesota right now, and that problem is spreading everywhere.
Right. In North Dakota, we're still hanging in there with enough beds so far, but they're worried. And you heard that in an interview that Todd did with a Stanford doctor this morning, that they are concerned about whether or not, you know, beds are going to become scarce.
Well, we talked with Shelley Peterson a couple of months ago as this was building. She's the president of the Long-Term Care Association of North Dakota. She's basically saying that long-term care visitation can't resume until the spread is controlled because these are the most vulnerable people.
Right, and they're getting it from the staff that they have there, which, again, a lot of them are in that 18 to 30 age group. Now, we don't want to, you know, cast blame on them. It's just the nature of the thing, the way the thing has kind of evolved here.
Well, again, when I look at Danielle's reports, her daily reports that break down the people who've died and their ages and all that, typically they do range in, you know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But there are a number of people in their 50s that were in yesterday's report. So
there was also one in the 20s.
Yeah. So
this is a non-discriminatory virus, believe me.
Okay. The Great Plains Food Bank has opened a regional service center in Bismarck, partly because of COVID.
Yeah. You've got a 10,000-square-foot warehouse that they're going to be shipping food to and then shipping food out of to serve basically western and central North Dakota. And they're talking about 89, you know, food pantries or soup kitchens or things like that. There's really been a demand. They've seen a major growth in demand. Last year they were handling about food for 100,000 people. Now they're talking about food for 130,000 people.
Well, okay, so stay tuned.
Yes.
Let's talk about the political issue that's been raging around District 8 in North Dakota because of the legislator who was elected who wasn't alive.
Right. Yeah, David Ondal died in October. His name could not be removed from the ballot. Lo and behold, he won enough votes to serve. Well, there's a vacancy because he's not there. The governor stepped in and said, I read the Constitution this way and I'm going to make an appointment. The legislature says, no, you can't. We passed a law several years ago that it is the district executive committee that is going to fill that seat. Then you have the Democrats who are saying, hey, we took third. There's no second place person. That person should probably be in there. So there's a little discussion about that, and it's going to the Supreme Court very soon. They want to get it done before December 1 because that's when legislators are seated. December 1st is when the term starts.
Well, this is a very politically loaded decision because whoever is picked in that seat, the governor has had some issues with people who served from that district before.
That's true.
And now he has an issue with his own attorney general.
Right. Well, this is not the first time with the attorney general. The attorney general saying, I stand for the laws of the state of North Dakota. He wrote an opinion. His opinion has the force of law until challenged in court. Well, the Burgum folks have three assistant attorney generals that were appointed by the attorney general, which is interesting. But the attorney general is going to be on the legislature's side, and that was reaffirmed by the Legislative Management Committee vote today. And the governor's got his attorneys, and I don't know if the Democrats are going to actually challenge this one.
Oh, well, again, stay tuned. More to come.
It is going to be interesting.
Right. Well, let's talk about the State Investment Board looking at the Legacy Fund and looking at it quite closely because I know that the state's budget picture isn't dire.
No.
But, of course, we're not through the woods yet either.
No, we're not. And you're talking about first there's the issue of the proceeds from the Legacy Fund and whether they should be used for general government. That's the way it was set up. There are some people who want to reinvest the proceeds into the Legacy Fund, but there are others who are also saying, hey, why don't we invest some of the principal Legacy Fund in projects for North Dakota? And there seems to be a growing interest in that, and that was shown by that survey of developers that was taken, that the vast majority said, yes, it should be invested in North Dakota. And there's been talk of an initiative measure to make it 100% invested in North Dakota, which I don't know if legislators are willing to go that far. But again, if it's an initiated measure and the people say yes, then they have to find out a plan to do that.
But that would be a sharp diversion from the initial intention, which was to have this big, this principle that kept growing because of the extraction taxes and the state's building profit margin, if you will. And
right.
Now they're looking – and they were always looking at just applying the profits.
The proceeds.
But if they go to the principal, that is a substantial change in policy.
It is a substantial change in policy. Those who are supporting it saying, hey, it will pay off because if we invested in some North Dakota projects, well, the money will A, be paid back, but B, possibly be paid back with interest because at least some of the leaders are talking about a state bonding program using the Legacy Fund as the money for the bonding, and then it would make money when the state pays back the bonds.
I noted on our news page at prairiepublic.org that you have another Energy Issues and Answers episode. This is
right.
From reclamation to fracking. You talked with Lynn Helms again, right?
Right, I did. And I have a lengthy interview where we talk about, putting that COVID money now, some of it, to fracking, which will be for four or five small operators to frack some wells. But also this whole idea about reclaiming oil wells, that project is continuing. And we talked about that, where they're at, what the next steps are going to be.
Well, in the meantime, they were using some of that CARES money to essentially employ people.
That is, and that's what they believe with fracking. It is going to employ people.
Okay. Well, let's end with something that was intriguing and, again, is related to the big story of the decade or century, and that is COVID. Camping numbers at North Dakota State Parks break records this
mm-hmm.
year.
Remember the whole campaign about take it outside during the summer months? The State Parks and Recreation Department saw real big spikes in September and October of people using state parks for camping. And they say that's partially due to A, COVID, but B, people just wanted to get out and to do something.
And they can do that and socially distance.
Absolutely.
The numbers you have up 173% in September and 339% in October. So previously those perhaps weren't popular camping times, but they are now.
They are now, and the weather stayed nice.
All right. Well, we check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Steve Martin and Jerry Seinfeld on comedy, plus some Beethoven from Yo-Yo Ma and Emmanuel Axe. An embarrassment of riches next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
That's coming up tomorrow at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean. And this week, Matt, we went to one that's been streaming, I know, because I saw it. And that's Borat Subsequent Movie Film. That's not even the whole title.
No, I'm going to give you the whole title. Yes, this has been a popular streaming film right now. The sequel to the 2006 Borat film, which I can't quite remember the long title, but this title, Doug, is Borat Subsequent Movie Film, Delivery of Prodigious Bribe to American Regime for Make Benefit Once Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan. And the bribe is his daughter. So Maria Bakalova plays Borat's daughter. And, of course, these are characters, you know. And in the film, she's 15. She's not 15 in real life, but she plays his daughter, and they come to America to bribe Mike Pence. And they're going to offer his daughter, his virgin daughter, to Mike Pence as a bride, and hopefully that will give money back to Kazakhstan. So that's the plot right there. And you know it's going to be crazy with what I just explained to you. So hilarity ensues. Again, Sacha Baron Cohen somehow gets himself into situations and events in costume, in character. There's a great sequence where he and Maria Bakalova get into CPAC, where Mike Pence is speaking, and he has a Trump costume on, and he's offering his daughter to Mike Pence, and you can see the look on Pence's face, like, who is this guy? It's amazing the access he gets. But Maria Bakalova is fantastic in this movie, Doug, and she's even getting some, you know, some Oscar talk as a Best Actress nominee because she's hilarious. The Rudy Giuliani segment has been much discussed in the news. That is amazing because he has clearly taken in that she is a legitimate reporter interviewing him about COVID. There's a fantastic sequence at a debutante dance where somehow Borat gets his daughter into a debutante dance in the South, and we can't really say what happens after that, Doug, because it is very inappropriate and very hilarious, but you'll have to watch the film. I also enjoyed when Maria Bakalova somehow invites herself into a Republicans women's club and gives a speech that starts out pretty interesting, and eventually the look on these women's faces as they listen to her is priceless. So it's a lot of misadventures. It's a lot of set pieces like that. Again, Sacha Baron Cohen, often compared to Peter Sellers because of his penchant for makeup, wild costumes, accents. He is I think if he's not a comedic genius, he's close. And I think this film is at least as good as the first one. Lots of streaming going on. I think people will enjoy it if you understand going in that they really, really push the envelope. If that is not your cup of tea, then you might want to skip this one. But the reviews are great. I never stopped laughing, and it's hilarious.
Well, it's a kind of film that I really enjoy. It's called a mockumentary. It takes fun of the documentary format and of people's, I guess, predispositions, if you will. It goes back for me with Spinal Tap, but I love these kinds of movies because they're largely, or at least significantly, improvised. It's an interesting form of movie making, and sometimes you wonder, how does Sacha Baron Cohen do it? Because his face has been around for a while now. He's kind of like a lanky Groucho Marx to me.
Yeah, a little bit. But he's in such heavy makeup and costume design that sometimes you can't tell it's him. For example, what I heard, there's a famous set piece in this film where he gets himself into this protest. It's a protest about mask wearing, okay? And he sings a song about Obama being a traitor, and his moniker is Country Joe or something, and he's singing up there. And apparently he did have one person kind of help him into this that was in on the whole joke, but everyone in the audience was loving it and loving his performance. They didn't know it was Borat. They didn't know it was Sacha Baron Cohen up there singing as some country singer. There's a lot of planning that goes on, I would guess, certainly to get Giuliani to go along with the fact that Maria Bakalova is doing a serious interview with him about COVID. And you can tell, you know, we're in on the joke. So we're watching this interview like, how could he be tricked into thinking she's a legitimate reporter from the Ukraine or Bulgaria or wherever she claims to be from. And then things go awry from there quite haphazardly as he goes into a motel room with Maria Bakalova. And that's about all I'll say about that.
Yeah, it's a scene that will linger with you. The other piece of this that intrigues me is that the nation of Kazakhstan, which is sort of the butt of a lot of these jokes, has embraced Borat.
Yes, they have. I know there was some pushback initially that he was making fun of the whole country, but they've embraced him, and I think he's probably their greatest ambassador, greatest ambassador right now. And I hope there's more movies to come. He is, like I said, he is really an artist who pushes the boundaries, but he does them, he pushes those boundaries, I think, in a way that is, I mean, look, there's some crude jokes in this. There's some references to things that are uncomfortable, but in his hands, for some reason, it kind of comes off like, okay, that's funny. I accept that. Do you agree with that, Doug?
Yes, I do, actually. And, you know, he's a legitimate actor. He's got some really good credits to his name.
Yeah, he's great in Hugo. I really like him in Scorsese's Hugo.
And we should also mention, because when I was looking at the movie, doing a little background check with Sasha and Borat, and there's plenty out there, there was a documentary made about the making of his movie in Kazakhstan.
Oh, boy.
That's one I'm going to look up, to be honest with you.
The making of the mockumentary. Okay, we'll have to look that one up next.
Yeah, and it strikes me as intriguing, because I would like to see behind the scenes how they do some of this.
I sure would, too. I would love to find out more. We've only heard snippets so far about how he got into CPAC and, you know, how he got into that mask protest with anti-mask people. But, it would be fascinating to see his backstory and his preparation in heavy character and heavy costume to get into these places. And let's face it, Doug, he uses Maria Bakalova as a way to get into these places. She's very attractive. She's very funny. And so, you know, clearly that's a way for him to get in to interview Giuliani. She's got this extremely high skirt on as she interviews him, and the whole scene is very uncomfortable. But we're in on the joke, so we're laughing with it.
Okay. Well, it's a movie that I might actually watch again, and I guess I give it a thumbs up. But I like mockumentaries, like I said.
Yes.
So I've got an Oscar trivia question that actually came from our producer, Skip Wood. It's completely off the subject we were on, but it is an intriguing question, and that is, best buddies, Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart, from the golden age of Hollywood, and they were great friends off screen,
were
in how many movies together?
So they were in the Cheyenne Social Club. Doug, I'm going to say three. The Cheyenne Social Club, Fire Creek, and How the West Was Won.
One more. There were four. On Our Merry Way.
Never saw that. Would not have gotten that one.
That's very obscure to me. I wouldn't have either. So we've been to the movies with Matt O'Lee.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. We're performing our full concert schedule this season. Details are subject to change. Don't miss Nutcracker Nuovo, November 20th and 21st, featuring Braden Drevlo on piano in a new twist on Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. For up-to-date concert and ticket information, visit BismarckMandanSymphony.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 13th. On this date in 1943, Earl Charles Reinecke married Jane Marie Early. He was a broadcaster, and she was a dancer and professional model. Earl Reinecke started out his illustrious career with a hobby, experimenting with crystal sets. In the earliest days of radio, these sets could be heard only through earphones and crackled with constant static. In the early 1900s, countless Americans assembled broadcasting sets and taught themselves how to operate them. UND Professor Hoyt Taylor had been broadcasting locally since 1916, using an ARC transmitter he built in his physics lab. For a power supply, he had to connect his transmitter to the overhead wire of the city's electric railway system. In the winter of 1916 and 17, Hoyt started broadcasting music from the station, reaching a radius of about 200 miles around Grand Forks. But his microphones kept shorting out, so the system had to be rebuilt every day for the next night's program. When UND secured a license for KFJM in 1923, they wanted to make the station profitable. So they installed remote facilities in area churches and hotels and charged them $3 an hour for broadcasts. Meanwhile, back in Fargo, World War I had ended, and Reinecke, along with Kenneth Hance and Lawrence Ham, had taken their hobbies to the next level and had started selling radio equipment. In 1922, they decided that a broadcasting station would promote more sales, so they formed WDAY, the first licensed radio station in North Dakota and one of the first 100 stations in the country. Reinecke and his partners needed a high location for their transmitter, so they set up shop in a small room in the Tower of Fargo's Cass County Courthouse. The studio contained a 50-watt broadcasting set, three chairs, a Victrola phonograph, a table, and the three men. After a year of competing with the tower's chimes and chattering sparrows, the men moved their station to a new location above the Topic Cigar Store. On top of the building, they constructed a 30-foot antenna. Now their programs reached as far as Hillsboro, some 40 miles away. By the 1930s, WDAY boosted its power to 5,000 watts and built a new transmitting station in West Fargo, maintaining studios in the Black Building downtown. And in the early 1950s, a television station was added, and evenings on the prairie were soon changed forever. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pipcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us for Main Street. You can find any Main Street show after the broadcast and online streaming at prairiepublic.org. Monday on our show, we'll talk with Carolyn Grimes, who played Jimmy Stewart's daughter in the holiday classic It's a Wonderful Life. Her career as a child actor in the movies ended when tragedy struck. And Ashley Thornburg will visit with Barb Solberg of Minot, who authored a student guide to online learning. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.